club football, he pisses all over him. So
yeah. It's just Messi. We all know what Messi can do.
A lot of flair, a lot of skill.
People might forget the names, but the street certainly won't. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whenever you're listening to this, welcome back to another episode of the FT Lyle podcast. We're at the height of summer. We should have been enjoying a summer World Cup, but it's a bit different this year. It's been moved to the winter, and we didn't want you to miss out on any World Cup action this summer. So our latest episode focuses on the very best players at the World Cup who never got to lift that famous Jules Rimet trophy. Joining me today on this one to help me is a bit of a World Cup expert. It's the author of the book World Cup Nearly Men, Mr. Aidan Williams. How you doing, sir?
Very good, and really pleased to be on the pod to talk about World Cups when, as you rightly say, we should have been enjoying a World Cup summer. And I think that's kicked in lots of people to reminisce about tournaments past and the things they're missing out on. So I think that's going to be great to get into this tonight.
Yeah, I think going back to the first lockdown, they replayed a few World Cups. I know they did the 1966 final. I think they did quite a lot of the 1986 World Cup as well and stuff like that. So I was well getting into that when there was no actual live football on the telly too, so that was good.
Yeah, oh yeah, totally remember all that. It was great for me trying to get my son into some of the stuff in the past. You're right, 86 did get a lot of coverage, didn't it, in the first lockdown, which was wonderful for me because that's one I remember vividly.
Good, good. So what was your sort of first World Cup then that you really remember?
1982. Yeah, exactly. Well, I was born not long after the 1974 World Cup, but that obviously I missed that. So 1982 is the first one I have memories of, usually centred around Zico and Paolo Rossi and that kind of thing. I do distinctly remember England's first game against France when Brian Robson scored within 20-odd seconds of the start. I really, really remember that being around a friend's house when that happened. There's other bits kind of come into the memory and fade, and I don't know so well, but the overall narrative and story of that World Cup, I do recall really quite well from the time and the impact it had on me, especially that Brazil team. And pretending to be Zico on the playground afterwards, with the occasional Paolo Rossi thrown in just to score a few goals. But 86, I guess, is what I remember more thoroughly. But 82, I would definitely count as my first real World Cup.
Okay. Yeah, for me, I think it was probably the 2002.
That makes me feel terrible.
The 98 one. To be honest, the 98 one, I more remember the merchandise. I remember getting a little ball of Footix in the McDonald's Happy Meal. that's probably my main memory of that World Cup. But yeah, 2002. And I think everyone my age would remember that England-Brazil game. We watched it in school, like schools throughout the country just had the tellies on and just everyone watching it. And I'm sure it would have been the same in offices and things like that up and down.
Oh, yes, we got to go to the hotel bar across from the office every morning to watch things there. So, strangely, people were more eager to turn up to work early, turn up to the office early rather than to work, so we could all congregate around a breakfast whilst watching it. It's an unusual experience because, obviously, by that time, I was well used to these things going on whilst watching in a pub. That wouldn't apply to you, of course, watching it at school. But yeah, that made it very strange, being in a bar, but having a glass of orange juice and then going to work.
Yeah, yeah. Is it similar in Qatar? I'm not sure what the time difference is. I don't think it's as much.
No, it won't be quite as bad. It won't be quite as bad.
Yeah, that would be interesting, though, a Winter World Cup.
Yeah, exactly. The whole congregating outside and the beer throwing all over the place, things like that. But, you know, the scenes that we see from Croydon Box Park and all these places, that's not going to happen quite the same way, I don't suppose.
No, I don't think it will. And definitely not at the actual country itself. That will be interesting as well, having what's supposed to be an alcohol-free World Cup. I don't know how that's going to go down.
I'm sure the official beer of FIFA will find a way.
Yeah, you're right about that, probably. But yeah, well, on to the topic. How did you find, well, this mind-boggling topic, really, of the best players at the World Cup not to ever win it?
Totally agree. It was like getting an awkward homework assignment that, you know, it's hard work trying to narrow down to 10. I wrote down a list that, probably had 15 to 20 names on it, and then went through and underlined a few and scrawled a few out and changed my mind one or two times. I think there's certain ones which I found quite easy to pick. Whether they match what you pick, I don't know, because as we're talking about, we come from rather different eras, so certain events will have had a greater impact on me and vice versa. So that'll be interesting to see where the differences are. But no, I think maybe half of my list I found easier and the other half less so.
Yeah, I had a few where, like, I definitely wanted to put them in, but I just didn't know where. And there's a lot of, there's too many honourable mentions to name, really, but
I'm sure we'll manage to mention a lot of them as we go.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, my criteria, I suppose, I mean, longevity kind of always comes into it a little bit for me. If they've had, you know, if they've broken any sort of record, and then obviously just how, you know, the impact that they've had. So there's one kind of outlier in my list that is a bit different from the rest of them, but just so iconic, so he had to be in there. But there is so many players that sort of played at one World Cup and just tore it apart and didn't play in any others. And they probably all could have got in the 10, but I just thought, they all had quite a similar impact. It was hard to narrow it down. And similarly, there's a couple of really iconic teams where I've not included any players in there. So Brazil 1982, you're talking about Zico. The likes of Zico, Socrates, stuff like that. Again, I couldn't particularly split them in terms of their World Cup form. I think Zico was definitely the best of the lot, like, throughout his career. But in terms of World Cup. And then the Hungary 1954 side, Puskas missed a couple of games in that tournament. I love him to bits, but he probably shouldn't have got the Golden Ball that year. And I don't know, because of the World Wars and things like that, and the Hungarian Revolution and stuff, they got split up way too early. So there's a few players that probably should have been on that list if they had played in 58 as well. But it's very hard. But did you have any sort of honourable mentions that you thought?
Well, this is, you're intriguing me here, because some of your honourable mentions might be on my list of of fully in. I think it depends. You're talking there about the longevity, and that's a good criteria. I maybe in some cases I've sort of taken the impact and overall, which can be on that one tournament. That's how it works, isn't it? And there's a few where I think, how to put it, I think, there's one I noted down and then rejected for being just too long ago, from the 1930s, which, Matthias Sindelar. And it's a fascinating story to look into for anyone who likes the football history. You know, he's a precursor to what the Hungarians did in many ways, of the withdrawn striker. So if you think of Hidegutti and that Hungarian team, Sindelar with Austria was kind of the first stab at that, if you like, the withdrawn striker, slightly freer role, hard to pick up, causing a bit of confusion in the very rigid opposition formations that there were at the time. Bit of a free thinker, free spirit, so you could see echoes of what the Dutch would become later on as well in that aspect. He was part of what was called a Wunder team of Austria then, who came, well, they got as far as the semi-finals in 1934, losing to Italy. There's all sorts of issues there around influence of Mussolini or otherwise, but I think they were possibly just slightly past their peak at that point. So he's one that I always love and always like to highlight. There's a few others where, you know, maybe I've picked one from the great Dutch team, but I could have easily picked a few others. You know, people like Van Hanegem, or you think of Ruud Krol and Arie Haan, who'd played in two World Cups all the way through. in every single game. There's others who've won, who've reached the World Cup final itself more than once, but never won, like Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, for example, in 82 and 86. There's a few in that German team who did go on to win it in 1990, but some of these greats who didn't, like Rummenigge, possibly more controversially, Schumacher, the goalkeeper, who flat Battiston in 82, a bit of a panto villain, but he was still a top player who didn't win the World Cup, having twice got to the final. I think others more recently who I've had to cull would be the likes of Battistuta. I think he was a great striker and obviously had fair longevity in terms of World Cups 94 and 98. He was right up there and he's still around by 2002, but maybe that team didn't do very well and his opportunity was more limited. But a terrific striker in both 94 and 98. So he narrowly missed out, I think. And I could even add in people like Michael Laudrup, who his two World Cups were separated by 12 years, but in both he had a big impact. In 86, Denmark were the sort of darlings of a fabulous style of play. You know, they wowed people like me with my wide-eyed teenage eyes at the time. Was I teenage? No, not quite. Not quite. I'm adding a few years to myself there. But I remember videotaping Denmark's 6-1 win over Uruguay. Videotape, that says a lot as well. I had to video it and then watch it the next morning before school. And it was just absolutely incredible what that team did in that particular game. And Laudrup was their finest player, LPR too, but Laudrup was the one with all the skill, really. And then again, played in 98 when Denmark got the quarterfinal and ran Brazil really, really close in that quarterfinal as well. So, yeah, I think they're probably the most honourable mentions I can come up with. A few others might get mentioned as we go through as well, as they come back to mind of when I've had to reject them.
Okay. Yes, Sindelar has had one mention on the podcast before, but it was on the top 10 Argentinian players because we were talking about Luis Monti.
Oh, yeah.
When he sort of marked him out of the game. So, yeah, he probably hasn't had the best press on it. But, yeah, that Austria side, like, I suppose there's a few. You could say the same about some club sides. Like, if the European Cup had been made before the 50s and if the World Cup had been played before the 1930s, then you could have a few different names on the trophy multiple times even, maybe. So that's just how it goes, I guess.
Yes. Yes. Well, plus all the self-isolation that certain countries imposed on themselves.
Yeah, very political back in those days, weren't it? Yeah. All right, so number 10. Who have you gone with?
Well, this is another hard aspect to put them in some sort of an order. So bear with me if these aren't entirely correct in terms of how I talk about them. But my number 10, I'm going to say Eusebio from 1966, a fabulous Portugal team. Now, he was obviously a phenomenal player. He's from Mozambique rather than Portugal. He was a bit of a trailblazer for African football as well as Portuguese football. And not the only one in that team. Mario Coluna was another Mozambican in that side who was hugely significant as well. But Eusebio was the star man. He'd obviously been hugely successful with Benfica through the early 1960s as well in the European Cup. He'd had hugely significant clashes with Pelé when Benfica played Santos in various times. And you could see that as a sort of slight handing of the baton across from one great to the next. Temporarily, I would add, because obviously Pelé came back to the top of the tree once again afterwards. But at this time, and you could see that again in Portugal's victory over Brazil in the group stage in 1966. Now, this is Brazil who'd won the last two tournaments. This is Portugal who'd never even been remotely close to a World Cup before. And then in the group stage, they give Brazil a battering in all sorts of senses. They give them a battering around the ankles and around the legs and all sorts as well as on the score sheet. But Eusebio was at the heart of all the positive action, as well as others being at the heart of the slightly more destructive action. But that was all part of the appeal. They had beauty and the beast in them, that Portugal side. And Eusebio had power, athleticism. He had the lot. There's some clips of some of the goals he scored. There's one in particular where there must have been a microphone nearby, but the sort of thud of his boot on the ball was so, it comes through like a shot. And then the ball smashes into the net. You just hear the sort of crackle of the net moments after the thud of the boot. It's just magnificent. He obviously scored an awful lot of goals that tournament. Notably too against North Korea in the quarterfinal, that incredible match when they were 3-0 down after about a quarter of an hour. And he scored four, I think, of their five goals to come back. And then they faced England in the semi-final. Now, I guess to English minds, we focus so much on the final of 1966 and the story of that game and how close that was, you know, West Germany equalising in the, pretty much the last kick of normal time. And obviously what happened in extra time, we focus an awful lot on that. But the semi-final, I think, gets a little bit forgotten of how Portugal probably pushed England into a greater performance than they had to in the final. That sounds a bit weird because West Germany obviously drew the 90-minute game of the final, whereas Portugal lost in the semi-final. But I think they pushed England to greater heights, tested them far more than anyone else. I think Eusebio was at the heart of that. He obviously scored their penalty to bring it back to 2-1. But largely forgotten to English minds, I think, is how close they came to equalising after that. And who knows what might have happened in extra time. But Eusebio, like Portugal, rapidly disappeared from the World Cup scene. They didn't even come close to qualifying for 1970. But he, as a player, was still performing great feats with Benfica. He was still one of Europe's finest, undoubtedly, at that time. For that brief period in 1966, and probably a little bit either side as well, I would say he was the best player in the world. English minds probably forget that a little bit, given what happened. Naturally so, I think, given that there's no other titles to acclaim. But I think for what he did in that World Cup and the player he was, he's my first pick.
So Eusebio is actually my 10. So this for me, so this was a toss up between Cristiano Ronaldo and Eusebio, and although Ronaldo's got a lot more sort of statistical records, he's never really impacted a tournament like Eusebio has. And like you said, Portugal hadn't been to a World Cup before, and then they weren't really a force on the world scene until like Luis Figo came along. And I mean, even then, they've not really threatened at a World Cup to the level they did in 66. And yeah,
you could say even when they reached a semi-final in 2006, and obviously Ronaldo was part of that.
They were never going to win that.
Exactly.
Like, right. Just there to make up the numbers, kind of thing.
Totally. Yeah.
But yeah, it's There's been a few of these kind of one-off tournaments, but this one. He's from a nation that, yeah, historically and in the future after this, hadn't really done anything. And, yeah, I think that assessment is definitely fair that he was the best player in the world around this sort of time, because sort of Pelé and Garrincha and stuff had probably been a bit past their peak. And obviously that great Real Madrid side had sort of come to a close. So, yeah, I think that's fair. And, yeah, just what he did in that tournament. And yeah, for African football, like you said, for him to be kind of on the world stage from Mozambique doing that, would have had a massive impact too.
Yeah, absolutely. And for Portugal, this is something I go into in my book as well, is a sort of impact for Portugal. It was kind of more by chance. And as you say, nothing of a similar status until their golden generation, the original golden generation of football came through. Figo and Rui Costa and people like that in the 90s. They had a Euro semi-final in 84, but again, that was a slight freak occurrence if you want to look at it like that. It was such an isolated incident, but it seemed to come from nowhere. And the reason is that the sort of international setup was very amateurish. The clubs, hugely professional, hugely forward-thinking, hugely progressive. And when they combined well, it caused these weird, massive peaks at international level, of which 1966 was obviously the biggest until more recent times. But yeah, it was more by chance than plan. It's weird how you can have such incredible peaks and then absolutely nothing in between.
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe that might happen with Belgium, but again, they've kind of just mainly flattered to deceive. Although they did get to the semis, didn't they, in their last.
Well, exactly. I mean, you could argue that's exactly the same as Eusebio's Portugal achieved, you know, a narrow loss to the ultimate victors, which I guess they did, but they didn't ever. I spoke with the great win they had over Brazil and the dramatic one over Japan. But you always, I think from further out in that tournament, we always kind of felt France were the likeliest winners. And therefore, when they got past Belgium, it didn't seem such a surprise.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know. I think this Portugal side now, this is definitely their last chance, because Ronaldo's what, 37, maybe even 38. I think he could still. This potentially could be his best World Cup, because he's not yet hit the heights. Could just be saving himself for like 6 or 7 games.
Well, you could see him a little bit like we mentioned Figo. So obviously, when Cristiano Ronaldo was coming through, Euro 2004 was his first tournament in Portugal. Now, Figo was then at the other end of the scale at that point, but there was the new generation coming through of which Ronaldo was obviously the pinnacle. But there were others too, and then maybe he is now that elder statesman with there's a lot of talented players there from Portugal who are coming through. But it never quite seems to click as it should. I think the way the style of play that they go for is never. It, I don't know. It just frustrates me anyway as somebody watching such a talented squad. That they don't cut loose a little more at times.
And
if you're not going to win anyway, you may as well go down fighting. That's what I think.
Yeah, a bit like Fernando Santos, he's a bit defensive, isn't he? And they've got a lot of players have played under Pep in that side, so they'll be used to something a bit different. But yeah, we're one for one in agreement so far.
Wow,
so
this is good. Yeah.
Surprising, to be honest. Who have you got at number 9?
Well, I suspect we won't agree now, given what you've mentioned about 1982. So I've gone for Socrates here. So that probably gives away what one of my later picks is going to be from a similar setting. But I've gone for Socrates, not just for his footballing style, which was hugely impressive and elegant, I think, is one word you'd use to describe him. But also the impact he's had off the field as well. You know, he's a very liberal-minded person in a time when Brazil was in a military dictatorship, a brutal military dictatorship. It was in its final throes, I guess, by this point. But he was, if you like, maybe I read too much into these things, but that's what the kind of perspective of time gives you. He seems like a sort of symbol of the changing of the tide. You know, he came into this team that had previously been a fairly rigid side that wasn't quite in the sort of Jogo Bonito style. You know, 1970 was all magical, and then 74 and 78, they were much more functional. Their coach in 78 was a former military officer rather than a football person. They became less exciting. And then 82 was the exact opposite of that. It was like going from one extreme to the other. You know, it was all about football art. And Socrates was the sort of heart of that. Other people maybe were sort of more dynamic and more eye-catching at times, but he was the sort of perfect symbol of that changing attitude. And then Brazil, the country, kind of caught up eventually and followed suit a year or two or a couple of years later. He went to the 86 World Cup as well, but again, that was on the downward slope, I guess, of his career. He didn't quite make it in Italy. He had a year in Italy and then went back to Brazil. I think it was just some people are best suited to certain settings and they get the best out of them. And I think he was one who very much needed to be at home. You know, he had a short spell in Yorkshire at the end of his career as well. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, he seemed to thrive in the home comforts, being part of a Corinthians team, which was run in a very democratic way, unlike anything in the country. He was the heart of that. But if we're talking pure football, he was part of a stellar midfield in 1982. I could throw out a name that we haven't picked is Adair, who was the more left-sided player. Scoring some incredible goals throughout 82. If anyone hasn't seen too much of the 82 World Cup, Brazil side, you know, just go on YouTube, some of the goals they scored. It's just a fantasy reel of astonishing shots coming in from here, there and everywhere. Adair and Socrates and Falcao as well were part of this great midfielder, and Zico obviously in there as well. But Socrates had that elegance. He had that sort of charismatic style. He was very much a sort of counterculture, hard smoker type of character who just did things the way he wanted to, lived life the way he wanted to, and played the way he wanted to. Scored a fabulous goal in that great game against Italy as well, causing the chalk on the goal line, or paint on the goal line, to puff up, which was a nice little, it's a vivid memory of that game. I say I've got various memories of 1982, and that, it stands out like through the decades easily to me. It's just that chalk puffing up as he fired the ball in at the near post past Dino's off, as though even the goal line was celebrating the greatness.
Yeah, he was, it's an interesting build that he had, wasn't it, as well, for a centre mid. I think in those days you didn't have so many that were sort of that size and could move the way that he did.
He was quite tall and wiry, yeah. Which, rather than the sort of dynamic enforcer type, or even as a playmaker, a bit more diminutive. But yeah, absolutely, very tall and wiry.
Mm. Yeah, and that Garforth Town spell. I don't know if you know, because I think I was about 10 when that when that happened, and I was like, what's he doing there? Because I'd sort of read about him and read about that 1980 team, and that was just, I'm not sure what that was. But you've seen it again with Roberto Carlos doing something for some sort of Sunday league side, and it was a little bit similar, some sort of PR stunt. But yeah, he was definitely a little bit before his time, as a lot of these great Brazilians were. But yeah, as I say, it was just so hard to pick a single one in terms of that. And was 1982 when they played France Magic Square as well? Was that 86?
No, that's 86.
That's 86. Yeah, that's another team that I couldn't pick anyone from, because I just couldn't. Platini gets the plaudits, but in terms of World Cup stuff, again, I couldn't pick anyone. But yeah, that's a solid shout. I would, just thinking back to a previous episode we did of the best ever international teams, and I'd be interested to see where you put the 1982 Brazil side.
Very, very high.
You
know, that's the kind of thing of them or the Dutch of 74 in terms of ones who didn't win. But obviously you've got, if you're talking greatest World Cup team, well, Brazil 1970 sits atop them all. Followed closely by Maradona, I guess, on his own in 86 in many ways. But, you know, those that have fallen short, this Brazil of 82, I would rate far higher than many that have won it.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send you that. I'll send you that one after, see what you think.
Yeah.
My number 9, he definitely doesn't have the elegance of Socrates, I would say, but again, he's very underrated, I feel, and that is Michael Ballack. So he was one of the stars of the first World Cup that I remember vividly in 2002. And he also was pretty good as well in 06. And really, for about 10 years, Germany were rubbish in terms of how bad Germany, you know, how good they normally are. And they still got to a World Cup final and a World Cup semi-final. And he was definitely, him and Oliver Kahn was the star man at 02. But because Kahn only played in one, really, he didn't really play in 06 much. I couldn't really put him in the list because of what Ballack did in the next one. Sort of carrying this great nation that below par, really, in terms of their history and stuff.
We'd all love failures as good as German failures, though, wouldn't we? You know.
Yeah, I know.
They may have done badly in a couple of Euros around then, but crikey, a World Cup final and a semi-final, that's terrible.
Yeah. But I do dread to think where they would have been without him, because I remember he was getting, I think, in at least two of the knockout games, he got the winning goal in that. And his record from midfield is incredible, really. And I'm an Arsenal fan, so I'm glad that he didn't join Chelsea earlier, but it would have been interesting to see him in the Premier League like earlier. If he had had his whole career here, I think he could have been at the very top of that sort of centre mid pile, potentially.
Yeah, he was a fine player, and obviously he missed out in the final in 2002 with a suspension. But I mean, soon after picking up that booking, he went up and scored the winning goal of the semi-final against South Korea, which, if you compare to, I don't know, Gaza's tears of 1990, it's a bit of a contrast in mentality and attitude, and I guess in sort of mental toughness as well. But I mean, yeah, he was a fine, fine player. 2002 was a frustrating year for him, though, because he was runner-up in the Champions League final for Leverkusen, runner-up in the German League and German Cup as well. I might be going too far, but I think they lost out on all sorts of fronts. And then Germany came second in the World Cup as well.
He did it again in 2008. He lost the Champions League final, the League Cup final, come second in the league and lost the Euros final as well. he's had a couple of years filled with silver medals. So yeah, he was. I think he goes under the radar a little bit.
Yeah, I've got to be honest. He didn't come to my mind at all. But no, it's a good argument you're putting forward. He was a fine player. I guess this is one where our difference in age shows, well, especially with both these picks we're talking about here, Socrates and Ballack, you know, that shows vastly which eras we're coming from, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a few players in that 2002 World Cup. Obviously, I knew about the Brazil lot anyway, but yeah, I think Kahn and Ballack particularly really struck a chord with me in terms of foreign footballers, I suppose, from that World Cup.
Yeah, Oliver Kahn, he's a good one to mention, because I think he's got to be right up there in the best goalkeepers to have not won it.
Yeah. I'd probably put him at the top of that pile, actually. But it was the one World Cup. But he did win the Golden Ball. I think he's still the only keeper to do that.
Yeah, I think, did they choose that before he spilled the ball for Ronaldo in the final?
I think they did choose that before. That's the problem. Like, that's why, that's another reason why, really, he didn't make it. Because he was essentially at fault for them losing in a way. But
Such a shame, though, for
it does happen, though.
Even how he played in the tournament, yeah.
As I'm sure we'll mention someone later, what's also happened. That sort of thing, messing up in the final. But, yeah, it's much later off for me anyway. But, yeah, number eight, who have you gone with?
Okay, I've gone for a defender this time, Paolo Maldini. He was, you know, we talk about elegance. He was a phenomenal fullback, highly skilled, highly athletic again. He could play in multiple positions, you know, he wasn't just restricted to his fullback option. He played in slightly different variations at times. But I mean, what a player, obviously, through his time with AC Milan. He had all sorts of success, but when it came to Italy, his was a tale of incredible frustration. So he was a young 21-year-old, I think, in 1990, in Italy's home tournament, where all of Italy thought they were destined to win. You know, this was the home of football at the time. Serie A was effectively the European Super League in those days. Italy was where everybody was. Everyone who was anybody who played in Italy. For the Italian players who were part of that, they obviously had to up their game to play with the likes of Maradona, Hullet, Rijkaard, etc. It was a sort of fantasy league time. And Maldini, he came through during that time. 1990, yes, semi-final, penalty shootout loss. Go fast forward 4 years, 1994, penalty shootout loss in the final itself. Maldini again in there. 1998, penalty shootout loss in the quarterfinal. He was around for. You could even extend it out a little further if you want in terms of his international career and frustration that he was then obviously part of the Euro 2000 team that were within a few seconds of winning winning a trophy only for Will Todd to equalise and then Trezeguet to win it in extra time with a golden goal. So his time with Italy, for all his achievements and accolades and incredible number of appearances and caps and all he contributed, was ultimately incredibly frustrating with 3 World Cup penalty shootout losses.
Yeah, so unfortunate the timing, because pretty much every other sort of centre-back partner or centre-back that played at the time or full-back won a World Cup.
It's incredible. It really is. I mean, even in the team he was in 1990, you see, there's a question mark here about Franco Baresi and whether he counts, because he missed a penalty in the 1994 shootout. He actually scored one in the 1990 shootout against Argentina. He was in the 82 squad, so officially has won a World Cup, but he didn't play. In fact, he had never even played for Italy at that time. His debut came during the Euro 84 qualifiers. Now, bizarrely, he was also in the 1980 Euro 80 squad, World Cup 82 squad, still had never played for Italy, and then played in 1983 in the qualifiers. But technically, he's won a World Cup, so I couldn't include him.
Yeah,
but
that's a little bit of a question mark. Because he's got a medal, hasn't he, though?
Yeah, he's got a medal, but he didn't contribute
medal,
to
so
it.
I did, yeah.
But I think it's only fair. There's enough great players to pick anyway who there are no question marks about. But he obviously crosses eras with Maldini. You know, they formed part of the great Italian sides of that time. 1990 and 94, obviously they came close. To Italian minds, 1990 is the biggest story, because that's, as I say, that's when it should have been to their minds. We might look at it and think, well, 1994, they obviously came closer. And I suspect we'll be talking about a key character from that in due course as well. But 1990 is the one that they feel they should have won. But again, Maldini, just like Baresi, were key parts of that. Maldini as a young player, as I say, but yeah, that's just the first of several really, really frustrating international tournaments for a great, great player.
Yeah, it's weird because, like, club-wise, Milan haven't done that much in Europe outside of when he was there. I think they might have won 1, maybe 2 European Cups without him out of the 7. But national team-wise, they've won quite a few tournaments.
And I guess you could even throw in, obviously,
a long stint, but he wasn't there.
Yeah, and 2002, I guess, I think he was there as well when they lost to a golden goal to South Korea and all the controversy that goes with that. To be honest with that, I think Italy were their own worst enemy with missed open goals and things like that before any talk of dodgy referees can come in. But yeah, he was part of that as well. He I think, was the one who on Jung Hwan jumped over to score the winning header as well. So yes, he was central to all the disasters of Italian World Cups. 4 World Cups, 4 hard luck stories. And then what happens the very next World Cup when he's not there? They go and win it.
Yeah, and he would have played with so many of those guys in 06 especially. it's mad. Materazzi's got a World Cup. He scored in the World Cup final. And he hasn't.
Well, you could do a whole other list there of the worst World Cup winners or something. You know, you could add in Stefan Givarsh from 1998 and people like that who they can always show they've got a World Cup medal, but my God, they're no good. There's so many other people more worthy.
I'm sure that is going to be a future list. I'm sure it will be. But yeah, that's he's on mine as well. He's a little bit higher up, but yeah, we'll get onto that, I suppose. But my number 8 is Gary Lineker. So he's the only Englishman on the list. He's England's top goal scorer in World Cup history. Golden Boot winner, almost wasn't that far off winning 2 in Italia 90. And yeah, just, you know, poacher, Mr. Reliable. Really good record for England. I mean, I know, like, he never held the record for the top goal scorer, but like Rooney and Charlton and stuff like that, he's got a much better goals per game record. Obviously, they sort of played a bit further back, especially Charlton. But yeah, he's just one of them that I think he's a bit synonymous with the World Cup, really. He won league titles with Everton, played for Barcelona, but I think it's England that you probably think of first when you think of Gary Lineker, and especially at that 86 World Cup.
Yeah, the two World Cups he was at, 86 and 90, they kind of bookend his time as an elite striker, I think, you know.
Yeah.
He'd been at Everton that year in 86, and that was his sort of big breakthrough at the top, I guess, and he moved on. He was only there 1 year, and he moved on after the World Cup. But yes, that internationally, I mean, what a breakthrough, the hat-trick against Poland in the third group game was where it all came good for him, and he never looked back. Without that happening, that particular game, and those three goals, and obviously gave him the confidence to go on and score the other three that he got in the tournament. I think it's just one of those moments where his career just turned. You know, he'd been hugely successful with Everton, as I say, but I think he suddenly became real elite with what he achieved at the World Cup. And it was all just based off that game against Poland where it suddenly all clicked into gear. I don't think the England team had been set up quite as well prior to that. You know, they'd lost to Portugal in their opening game. They'd drawn with Morocco, who would ultimately win the group. So that was no sort of huge embarrassment, really, although at the time it was seen that way. Brian Robson injured, Ray Wilkins sent off, forced a little change in how the team would play. Peter Beardsley comes in to support Gary Lineker, and that's the key thing, I think. That suddenly made the sort of penalty area his own, because Beardsley liked to be a little bit more withdrawn, the perfect foil for a striker like Lineker, and it just worked brilliantly. I think Lineker still sore about the goal Beardsley got against Paraguay in the second round, because he was off the field for treatment at the time, and Beardsley scored from the position Lineker would have been in. He's mentioned that a few times. He's like, yeah, that should have been me. That should have been another one.
Yeah, I've definitely heard him talk about that one. In many ways, the 90 World Cup was more... He got more crucial goals in that. I know he didn't score as many, but... Well, it is hard to say, but like Poland, he got the hat-trick, didn't he? Potentially one would have done, because they won 3-0.
Yeah.
But in the 90, you got them two crucial goals against Cameroon, and then you scored against Germany, which ultimately didn't lead to victory, but it was, you know, a crucial goal at the time, and then you got a goal in the shootout as well. And yeah, it's weird. Like he's probably not viewed as good as many other players, kind of with that many World Cup goals, because he's got 10, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Something like that. And that puts him among the true elite. So it does look a little bit like an outlier, but he's obviously just brought his kind of A game to two World Cups, really. And that's why he got the move to Barcelona.
Yeah, that's right. And you think 1990, you're right to say that they're sort of crucial goals. I mean, you wouldn't have wanted anyone else stepping up against Cameroon. I mean, the equalising penalty was only about 7 or 8 minutes from the end. They were very, very close to being knocked out by what was a fabulous Cameroon side. Let's be honest. Oh, God, I remember that game vividly. The ringer that they put us through in that one was quite something. Just as a total aside from Gary Lineker, the other key character of that game was Roger Miller for Cameroon, of course, and he was a 36 or 38 year old, forget what it was.
He was a consideration as well.
Exactly.
I mean, how old he was as well. Like.
Exactly, to break through. I mean, he played in 82 as well, but not obviously with this impact. But he was semi-retired. He'd been in 2 years playing in the island of Reunion in the Indian Ocean, semi-professional. Came from, got called up from there to help the squad. He didn't start any game. He came off the bench in every single game, but in every time he changed it. And I just distinctly recall that game against England, just seeing him warming up on the sideline, and everybody English was terrified at the sight of this 38-year-old half fit semi-pro from the island of Reunion warming up to come on in a World Cup quarterfinal. But he changed that game as well. He won the penalty and he set up their second goal, all within a few minutes of each other. And my God, that came so close to knocking England out. But yes, you wouldn't have wanted anyone other than Lineker stepping up for those penalties, which he, of course, won himself as well, with a sort of canny knack of making sure he he nudged the ball past the on rushing goalie and incoming defender to make sure they hit him as well, which was expertly done.
Probably learned that in Spain. That's what they would say.
But also the goal in the semi-final, I think, is an absolutely fantastic goal. Again, this was only a few minutes from the end, 82nd or something like that minute. So this was very, very critical moment. England had given as good as they got in that game, which was England's best performance, I think, of that tournament. They raised their game to the levels. West Germany had been at that level more, I think it's fair to say. But England sort of matched them in that game. Unlucky goal against England, of course, with a deflection and Peter Shilton's concrete boots stopping him getting off the ground. But yeah, it was a fabulous equaliser. The way the ball came across, control on the thigh and thumped it into the corner. Oh, what a moment that was, but all it did was set up more pain, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Right, so number seven, who have you got?
Right. Well, here's someone who would, in lists of great players, would feature higher than number seven, I would guess, especially for younger minds. But I've gone for Lionel Messi at number seven. This is partly because those ahead of him, I think, have had more significant World Cup moments or World Cup impact. But he obviously is one of the finest players there's ever been and hasn't won the World Cup. Whether he still will, I guess there's another possibility, one last possibility, I guess, for him as well as for Cristiano Ronaldo coming up later this year. I think it's a slight frustration here too, in that 2010 could have been a great chance for him, but they were led by Maradona, and it's as though they kind of wrote off that tournament.
Yeah.
It was like they obviously felt they had to let Maradona coach them eventually, and it's as though just throwing away a World Cup though, when Messi was still young, but you know, very much a top player, and there was a strong supporting cast as well. Whether they were as good as Spain, that's a whole other matter. But they kind of threw that one away. 2014, obviously, was when they came by far the closest. Now, it was a good team they had then, but they were in a lot of very tight games. But Messi was the one who stepped up at the crucial moment to just go and win it for them when they needed to. In the group games, there were several very late goals that he scored to win it for them. The goal he got in the last few moments against Iran being the most obvious case in point, which was a fabulous pinpoint shot from one corner of the box into the far corner of the goal. They didn't exactly brush people aside on their way through to the final, but they did get there with Messi, their sort of creative heart, but all the attention was obviously on him to match what Maradona had achieved for Argentina. A different time, a different style and so on. You could only ever do that kind of thing in a more collective way in the modern times rather than the huge individual impact that Maradona had. But Messi was there and he was helping them and pushing them on. And when it got to the final, I think, again, we can overlook it because of how well Germany did in their semi-final. I think there was more than one factor to that. It wasn't just German excellence. There was a bit of Brazilian chaos as well to throw into that scoreline. I think that kind of masks the fact that Germany hadn't done anything other than that game beyond what Argentina were doing. There was close scrapes all the way through for them against Algeria, against France. So that weird one game makes us think, well, obviously Germany were the right winners. And yeah, probably as a team overall, sure, I guess they are. But when it came to the actual final, Argentina should have won that final. They had several clear-cut chances. I think Higuain is the one who would be the most pained by the opportunities missed. The one he did get in was offside. But Messi, too, had a glorious chance at one point and nudged it wide when he only had Neuer to beat. Overall, they had the chances to win that final. They really did. And for someone who, until last year, when he finally got a trophy for Argentina in the Copa America in 2021, this was just the frustration that he couldn't deliver a trophy for Argentina. He was delivering the performances, he was delivering the goals, but he couldn't deliver a trophy. They followed up 2014 World Cup final loss by losing the final of the Copa America in 2015 and 2016, both on penalties, yeah. Both to Chile. So again, his tale was seeming like one of utter frustration internationally, but he obviously got that monkey off his back last year. But I think in terms of World Cup performances, obviously he is the kind of player who has all the magical skills, all the box of tricks to do anything he likes, but he hasn't quite been able to get it over the line in a World Cup. But 2014, as a collective, they really, really should have done in that final.
Yeah, I don't know if XG was about in those days, but I'd like to see that. I think they would have dominated, because even the actual goal from Germany was, I think, a pretty hard chance for Götze to actually put in. And yeah, I felt that was strange as well after that game, a bit like we talked about Oliver Kahn when Messi got that golden ball award, because Neuer's surely got to win that. But I do think Messi just gets held to a higher standard than other players. So like that international trophy, monkey on his back kind of thing, was just there. And to be honest, for me, I had Ronaldo above him as a player, I think, at one point. But now I can kind of see it's Messi's definitely ahead, really. He's just got other stuff to his game that meant, like, I remember in 2010, he didn't score in the tournament, but the first two or three games, he was really running things, creating loads of chances. I think he might hit the woodwork about four or five times as well. And that was arguably peak Messi, like...
That's why it's so frustrating, isn't it? Yeah. It's so frustrating that they seemingly just threw it away. Literally against Germany in the quarterfinal, they threw it away. But it seems like the whole tournament was just like, oh, we've got to let Maradona have a go. And,
is that the one where they lost like 4-0, didn't they, in that?
Yeah.
I know they didn't bring Zanetti to the tournament. I don't think they bring Diego Milito either. Possibly even Cambiasso. I think he didn't bring any of the...
Well, this was another thing about Maradona, wasn't it? He picked...
Martin Palermo,
exactly, yes. I mean, his loyal servant at Boca, somebody he supports as a fan, of course, loving Boca Juniors. But, not international quality to that extent, at that level. Yeah. From a Newcastle perspective, they also had Jonas Gutierrez playing at fullback, which was a weird thing to see. It's just these odd decisions that essentially meant they destroyed their own chances.
Yeah, I think Maradona might have said that Jonas Gutierrez is one of his most important players.
I love Jonas Gutierrez. He's a wonderful guy and a wonderful player, but he's not that caliber.
especially for a team like Argentina. But yeah, that's I've got him as well, but a bit higher, but I'll mention him. My number seven is a guy that I know you put in your honourable mentions, Michael Laudrup. So going back to the ITV and the 86 reruns and stuff, they put Denmark Uruguay on, and what a game. And that just kind of made me fall in love with that Denmark side, and definitely a better Denmark side than the one that won Euro 92.
Oh, God, worlds apart, yeah.
Yeah, it's so exciting. And even, as you said, 98, Quick ended his international career. I don't know if that was a little bit sentimental, him getting in the team of the tournament or not, but, they did quite well at that tournament, especially for, like, a country of that size and stuff. And just, he did encapsulate what a World Cup was all about, his career, and that he kind of had his breakout moment in the first one, and then a bit like we've seen so many stars have a great World Cup on their last kind of their last hurrah in their career, which is what he did. And Denmark, I do know they do have a very good record of getting out of the group stage in World Cup tournaments, but I think a lot of that probably is down to the two that Laudrup were in, because I don't think they've been in that many other than that, maybe two or three other ones. But he really, really helped put them on the map.
Totally. And for people of my age, I mean, you say you came back to it, obviously, after the fact when the replays were on and sort of could see the appeal of that team and fell for them. You know, and you imagine the impact it had on somebody at the time. And I said I was a teenager earlier, which was wrong. I was 11, nearly 12 at the time. And as a school kid, watching that kind of football coming through in such brilliant colour from the midday sun in Mexico, it was dazzling in all sorts of ways. Just the actual style, the as well as the images, it was magnificent. And Laudrup was the heart of all of that. Elkjær was, you know, his sort of foil. He was a bit more, I wouldn't say conventional in terms of style of play. He was a bit more robust in style of play. Still had skills. Yeah. But he was a bit more direct, a bit more fight about him. Together, they were magical because it kind of, they brought a bit of the yin and yang to it. You know, it kind of just worked perfectly together. So many other talented players in that squad as well. Arnesen, I think, would be a key one. And he was part of the reason that they fell apart a bit against Spain, because he was banned for that knockout game.
Yeah, unfortunately. So you look at that game and you think, oh, wow, they got absolutely battered. But it was really just, They lost the man, got hit on the counter. It's a very even game. And
it was.
Probably one that comes to mind, as the scoreline definitely doesn't tell the full story.
It doesn't, yeah. And Jesper Olsen, obviously the villain of that game, if you like, the one who gave away the first of Spain's goals. He was a fabulous player at that time. Obviously, he moved to Manchester United and we got to see him over here. He was an absolutely fabulous player. And a key part of what this Denmark team could do. And obviously they got to the Euro semi-final the 2 years earlier as well, which was a sort of breakthrough. Although to those of us in this country, that tournament was barely on television, so we didn't really get to see it. So this 86 team, it didn't come from nowhere, but to young people viewing, it seemed like it had come from nowhere, because we wouldn't have known so much about the background of what had happened. They'd knocked England out of the Euros qualifiers a couple of years earlier, but I was too young to fully appreciate that, I think, in terms of what was going on. So the way they came through in Mexico 86, it was astonishing. But it's like a sort of brilliant firework that explodes really brightly, but very quickly it's just disappeared and gone and fizzled away to nothing, and that's what it seemed to happen. The obvious story, or the lazy story, if you like, is that they just went chasing the game too early and fell apart. But you're right, that isn't quite how it played out. Even after they'd given away the equalising goal, it was still playing as it was before, really, with Denmark being the ones dominant but not going gung-ho, not going crazy. And it was only in the last few minutes, I guess, goals 4 and 5, where they really got picked off. But obviously, you have to push on at that point. It was incredibly unfortunate. And it denied us, coinciding with the Soviet Union losing their last 16 game to Belgium, it denied us fantastic teams going head-to-head in a quarter-final, Denmark and the Soviet Union. They played a great qualifier the year before. They were in the same qualifying group. They played a great qualifier in 85 in Copenhagen. The Denmark won, but it was everything great about football. You know, it was played in a fabulous atmosphere in Denmark, but the sort of style of both teams and how they played was wonderful on that occasion. That's a great one to look up for those who don't know much about that particular game. That's one well worth looking into. But it could have been the quarterfinal in Mexico if they hadn't both lost out when expected not to do so. The Danes, obviously, in spectacular style against Spain, and the Soviet Union lost out to a couple of controversial offside goals to Belgium. And instead of Denmark, USSR, we had Spain, Belgium, and it was slightly less dramatic.
May have never got that picture, though, of Maradona in the next round.
Well, exactly. But it would have been fun if we'd ended up with a Denmark-Argentina semi-final. I would have loved to see.
That would have been Laudrup against Maradona, wow.
And that was an era of fabulous number 10s. This was, you know, there'd been a bit of drudgery of some of the years before. 82 kind of showed a way of a purer style, if you like. And then 86, by that stage, the cynicism hadn't yet come in, the pragmatism hadn't yet come in. And you had so many fabulous number 10s, obviously. Maradona chief among them, but, you know, Laudrup, there's Francescoli, Didn't have the impact necessarily at this tournament, but another elegant player, Platini, obviously, and various greats at that time in that position. It was a fabulous time for that kind of creative, dynamic spark of a player, and Laudrup was right there amongst the very best.
Yeah. Did you know that Zidane named his son after?
I didn't know that.
Well, that is the rumour anyway.
Francescoli played in Marseille for a good portion of his career, and that's where Zidane is from. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fact then. Number six,
where are we? Okay, yes. I've gone for Dennis Bergkamp as my number six. Now, okay. This is a lot to do with one particular game and goal, which was the 1998 quarterfinal against Argentina. The goal he scored, it's just defies sort of logic in some ways. The way the ball was played up to him, not a long ball, but very much a long pass from one of the De Boers, Frank, I'm going to say. Might be getting the wrong one.
It was, yeah.
50-yard pass or so, really coming down from a great height, controls it with his instep immediately. Second touch to nudge it past Ayala, who was poised to challenge, and his third touch on the outside of the boot past Roa in goal. Very satisfying for English fans because Argentina had obviously just knocked England out in rather painful circumstances only a few days earlier. So not just the Netherlands were cheering when that goal went in, but many English people too. But it was an absolutely magnificent goal. The way he sort of wheeled off celebrating with his head in his hands, covering his face a little bit, kind of showed that he felt this was something magical as well. He's described it as the perfect moment, and it really, really was. I think that's enhanced by a couple of other things in that game as well. One is the magnificent assist he provided for Kluivert's goal earlier in the game, which the ball coming into the penalty area, he's falling backwards as he sort of cushions a header into Kluivert's path. The fall was part of how to make sure it fell right for Kluivert. It was absolutely magnificent, and it just laid it on a plate for Kluivert to score. The other thing that makes the second goal the moment of perfection is the fact that minutes earlier he'd given the ball away in a sort of careless manner. And I think that kind of appeals to me on a level of, you know, perfection. He achieved it, but, you know, it's only momentary. There's all these other moments where it was less perfect. He had a robust side to him as well. You know, he kind of got stuck in, but he could also give it away and nearly give away the chance to Argentina to win it. I think that's the forward play where Ortega got himself sent off. And moments later, it's up the other end and he scores that wonderful goal. I think, again, his is a tale of international frustration. We talk about Maldini in that regard. Bergkamp came onto the scene in Euro 92 when the Dutch were the best team there and should have been able to win, but they managed to lose to Denmark on penalties in the semi-final. That was where the two eras crossed over the most of the, you know, the 88 winners, the likes of Van Basten, Rijkaard, Hullet, Koeman and so on, plus Bergkamp coming through and other new names. 92 should have been a sweet spot for that, but they managed to mess it up when they really should have been able to win. USA 94, Van Basten was gone by then, injured. Hullet pulled out, so it wasn't quite the same crossover. They got to the quarterfinal, and they only really started playing when they were 2-0 down to Brazil, and that's another frustration. As soon as they really went for it, they got two goals, Bergkamp getting one of them himself. Got right back into it, only to lose to a Branco curling free kick soon after. And then you've got the 1998 frustration. Those magnificent moments there, talked about against Argentina. They then got to a semi-final against Brazil. Like Denmark, who were mentioned before, they gave Brazil an awful lot of problems, as would France in the final, of course, although there's other factors there. But I think the Dutch gave them the sternest test when it was Brazil playing to their full capacity. They weren't obviously at full capacity in the final. Ronaldo did get a goal against them, but that was really the only moment he had. You say the only moment, it was a crucial goal, but yes, he was shackled in a way that he hadn't been so much in the rest of the tournament. Edgar Davids and Stan, was he there by then? And the De Boers and so on. There was a lot of quality play that was keeping Brazil at bay. Bergkamp, ironically, didn't have his best of games in that semi-final, which they ultimately lost on penalties. Had he been able to play in the way he did against Argentina, I think they would have won. And I think they would have beaten France in the final. That's my personal opinion. Other opinions are available. That's the way I see it. I don't think this Brazil team was that amazing, except for one phenomenal player that they had. And I don't think that France team was that amazing either. I don't think Zidane could hold a candle to Ronaldo at that time, as influential as he was. He went in fits and starts through that tournament, as did Bergkamp too. But I think he had another level that at that point Zidane couldn't reach.
Yeah, I think the French players were saying that they were more scared of the Dutch mm-hmm. than they were scared of Brazil. So they were happy when Brazil won. And yeah, I didn't have Bergkamp in mind because yeah, I just think, yeah, there were so many names in that Dutch side. And then also 2002, well, so they didn't qualify, but I'm not sure he wouldn't have been able to go anyway. By that point, he'd not given up line, hadn't he?
So. Yeah, I think he'd moved on by then. Obviously, he was part of Euro 2000, where another international trauma that they had in penalties in the semi-final and penalties in the main game, in fact, against Italy. But yeah, I know. I would agree that this isn't necessarily one that others may pick, but I think the impact that I recall from that time of that particular game and that particular goal, I think that warrants it from my perspective, because I think that was just so perfect a moment.
Yeah, I think he would have definitely won the Ballon d'Or if he had won the World Cup that year, because he had a great year with Arsenal as well, player of the year in the Premier League. So, yeah, that was him at his absolute peak
mm-hmm.
before Henry came along, really. I've gone for another Dutchman at six. I've gone for Johan Neeskens, who got to two World Cup finals, the 78 side. Doesn't really hold a candle to the 74, but yeah, he was present in both team of the tournament in 74 and got a goal in the final. And yeah, just one of the best midfielders of his generation. We did a podcast on the best Dutch players before, and I think he come in at sort of number 4 or 5, something like that. And yeah, he just could do it all, really, and a key part of that whole total football thing, because yeah, he had all the qualities that you need to really succeed in that system. And yeah, this was another one growing up where I think a lot of people were obsessed with Cruyff, but I did like a bit of Neeskens as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, you had that. He was a very cool looking character. Terrific player. I mean, there's so many from that team you could pick. It's just a nightmare of what to do in those cases. You know, you look at Van Hanegem as well, was probably the best player in the 74 final. I think he didn't go to 78 as with Cruyff for different reasons, but you know, hugely influential. But yes, Neeskens, yeah, I mean, he obviously scored the goal in the 74 final as well, didn't he? Before the Germans had even touched the ball.
Yes, yeah.
Which is quite something. Can you just imagine that? We obviously have only ever seen that from a knowledge of knowing what happens anyway. But you'd imagine just watching a World Cup final now and one team scores without the other even touching the ball. It would just be incredible.
Hmm. And a team like Germany as well.
Yes.
They'd be the last team you'd expect to concede within a couple of minutes.
Yeah, but I mean, well, we'll come on to... I will anyway. Whether you do or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I think
I will come on to other key characters of that. But there's so many that you could also pick from this team. Ruud Krol, I mentioned earlier, Ari Hahn, Johnny Rep, Rensenbrink, who hit the post in the 78 final. You know, it's just a stellar roll call of names, and Neeskens is, yeah, very much central to it all.
I didn't want to pick too many from one team, but I think he had to be on this one for me. But yeah, we're getting now into the top five. true elite. So who have you got at number five?
Number five, well, I'm already guessing this is one that you don't have from a comment you made before. I've gone for Michel Platini.
No, I don't love him.
Obviously his three World Cups he went to, 78, 82 and 86. They had a strong team in 78, but he was yet to reach his full peak, as was that France side. 82, they came agonizingly close to a place in the final. They'd lost their opening game to England, of course, that year, but handily that actually gave them the easier second round group, and gave England the harder second round group.
The Schumacher game.
That was the semi-final, yes. So they were against West Germany, who'd put England out by this point. In the semi-final, it was 1-1 at the end of normal time. Then France went 3-1 up in extra time. Now, how can you lose from this position? 3-1 up, but it ended up 3-3. But yes, during this game, Patrick Battiston had been put clean through on goal and got to the ball first ahead of Schumacher and nudged the ball past him, but wide of the goal. Schumacher jumps with his hips at Battiston's head height, turns himself so his hip bone smacks Battiston full in the face, inside the penalty area as well, I should point out. And yet the referee saw fit to not even give a foul. He gave a goal kick for this.
Oh, I thought he gave a free kick to Germany. I thought that's what that's...
It was a goal kick
for
the Germans. Nothing for France. Battiston is lying out cold on the pitch. He, as well as various teeth getting knocked out, he'd fractured some vertebrae. He was out cold. He went briefly later on, I think, into a coma. Platini thought his colleague and friend had died on the field. And that's how severe this was at that point. That's what they genuinely thought. Platini sort of walked off the pitch with him. He was the captain, of course, as well as the sort of leading light, holding Battiston's hand, while Battiston's other hand was across his chest in the way you might lay someone to rest. That's what it looked like. And obviously he wasn't. Well, coma is obviously very serious, but he wasn't at death's door. He did pull through. But I mean, what a villain of the piece you could create from West Germany there, and what a hard luck story for France. Would they have got past the resurgent Italy in the final? I don't know. But it would have been nice to have seen. That would have been a more pleasing game than what West Germany were able to give, because everybody was already against West Germany from that tournament, given the contrived victory over Austria in the first round that had essentially been fixed to make sure they both got through at Algeria's expense, Algeria who'd beaten West Germany. So everybody was very much against West Germany. They then knocked England out, which put English against them as well. And then they did this. But they met again in 86 in the semi-final as well. Now, we mentioned the great quarter-final with Brazil earlier on. So that was in 86, Platini central to all of that. That was actually his birthday, no less, and he scored an equaliser and then he missed a penalty in the shootout on his birthday. But they still got through from one of the great World Cup games. Now, that 82 semi-final was another of the great World Cup games. So was this 86 quarter-final with Brazil. And Platini was at the heart of it all. We talk about great number 10s of that time, and he was, for a time, the world's finest player. I'd say until Maradona reached his peak, Platini was the best player in the world. So this was kind of when that baton had moved on, really, to Maradona at this point. But Platini was very, very good as a player. It's easy to kind of ignore some of it, given what we know of him in the future as administrator. I know that recently he's been let off by the Swiss law courts for these strange payments between him and Sepp Blatter, but I think, you know, there's been all sorts of strange things going on when it comes to his administrative leadership and you know, other ideas, financial fair play, Euros all across the continent and so on. That was all his doing. The World Cup in Qatar is his doing as well, because he caused the vote to change on that one. So there's an awful lot to castigate him for in those regards. But as a player, I just can't forget how good he was as a player. And for all Zidane's achieved as a French player, I don't think that he is even close to Platini in terms of excellence as a player.
That is a big shout out. But Zidane is an interesting one because in the very biggest moments, well, I'll say that he got those 2006 World Cup, but generally he's got some of the biggest moments in football history. But yeah, Platini is a wonderful player. Yeah, he probably should be in this 10, to be fair. But there was a few teams where I just couldn't really pick out. Like I wasn't aware that he was particularly better than the other midfielders in that side.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it was a magnificent midfield. Yes, so the Tiganar, Alan Giresse, Luis Fernandez had come into it by 86, or in 84 as well, when they won the Euros, obviously. Platini scoring 9 goals in 5 games, though. So he was kind of part striker and part midfielder. He was a bit of both, but in one player. He didn't quite have the same phenomenal impact as he did in the Euro 84 in either of the World Cups either side. He wasn't fully fit in either of those World Cups, you know, niggly things, whereas in 84 he was completely fit, which may or may not have had an impact. Quality of the opposition may have had an impact as well. But the fact, I think he was more than a playmaker, more than the sort of tip of that magic square we talked about. He was also a striker in the same position. He was a phenomenon as well.
Yeah, we've had someone called Michael Hamlin on 80s and 90s football a couple of times, and yeah, he absolutely raves about Platini as well. But that's interesting you say that he was the best in the world before Maradona, because yeah, I didn't really know at that time whether that'd be him or Zico.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of crossover of era. Possibly Zico, then Platini, then Maradona would be how that rating would go. And maybe Platini's time as the number one was brief, arguably. But I still think that in that period from 84-85, certainly he was that top man.
I didn't realise he played at 78.
Yes, yeah. But France didn't quite have the same impact. But yes,
yeah. Yeah, because his career was fairly short, like, compared to some of the other great players. I think it's only like 11 or 12 years or something like that. But he obviously managed a lot, and he managed to win 3 Ballon d'Ors in that time, which is crazy, really. But yeah, top player. My number 5 has been mentioned already, and it's Lionel Messi. I think, unlike Ronaldo, he's brought a lot more than just like goals. 2 World Cups, and while I don't think he should have won the Golden Ball in 2014, he was very good at that World Cup, and he was very good in 2010 as well, from what I can remember. And again, 2006 even, he kind of just broke through a little bit. I think he might have been the youngest goal scorer at that particular tournament. And you just sort of got that first flash. At that point, I don't think he was wearing number 10. He's probably wearing number 30 or something. And I suppose I include him at number 5 because I expect him to do something at this World Cup as well. I think South African are going to win it.
Okay. All right.
Could even go further up the list, potentially. But it's a weird one because his international career, especially his World Cup career, is kind of not anywhere near as good as his club career. But there's certain statistics, especially about playmaking and stuff, which I appreciate they didn't really have statistics in those days around like key passes and dribbles completed and things like that. But he's just off the charts on all that stuff. So even when he might not be making the killer goal or, you know, assist, he's still influencing the game in other ways, really. So yeah, I think he's got to be fairly high up in my 10, I think.
There's people I've put ahead of Messi who aren't as good players as Messi.
Yeah, Well, I've got people ahead of Messi that aren't as good players as
Exactly. But there's different levels of impact or different perceptions of impact that, you know, I have one perception, you have another, I guess, in certain cases of their impact on tournaments and so on. But Messi's in the list for me, so all okay with that one.
Okay. Number four.
Right, I've had a bit of a tinkering of the order with these last few, so whether I've got it right, I'm not sure. But I've gone for Zico as number four. As we were just talking there with Platini, he was obviously one of the best players in the world and the very best for a period of time, probably between 78, 82 into 83. He was absolutely astonishingly good. They came relatively close in 78, despite, as I'd said, being rather less spectacular as a team. You know, they only missed out on the final thanks to Argentina's hatful of goals against Peru in the last group game.
Oh, yeah.
82 was obviously the peak for that side. I mean, we talked about the side already, but Zico was the principal man. He was the main guy. He was the star. He's the one that we all tried to emulate, the one we all wanted to be. He was the name. The name Zico just sort of, it just works as well, doesn't it? It just embeds itself in your mind. To anyone of my age, growing up as a young lad, Zico just meant anything extravagant and skillful. And everybody tried to be him, and nobody could obviously do any of the things he was doing. He was the heart of it all in that wonderful attacking play. He scored several great goals. He was the heart of their forward momentum, more so than the lumbering striker who didn't quite fit the lineup for them in 82. But he was everything that was great about them. As much as I've talked about Socrates and mentioned Adair and Falcao, and I could list others like Junior and Leandro and Toninho Cerezo as well, another fantastic player. But Zico was above them all. Just, I can just still see it vividly, the bright yellow shirt, the huge grin, the arms lifted high as he's just been the heart of some other magnificent bit of play from that team in 82. For him to have not won a World Cup, because obviously he was in 86 as well, but he wasn't fully fit. He came on in that great game against France that we talked about, came off the bench. Brazil won a penalty soon after that, which he took, and he should never have taken it because he wasn't matched up to speed in the match. He wasn't really with the flow of the game, and he took this penalty and missed it. And Brazil ultimately lost. But I think he, again, was past his peak by that point, as was this Brazil side. 82 is when it should have happened. And it would have been a wonderful boost for joyous, free-flowing, attacking, carefree football if they had one. But maybe it's one of those where is it a more beautiful story that they didn't, because it was just, you know, they just threw so much caution to the wind. They couldn't, even when only needing a draw against Italy, they couldn't bring themselves to have a dose of the pragmatism about it and to sort of shut up shop a little bit just to make sure they held on for the draw and a place in the semi-final. It just wasn't in their nature. And ultimately it cost them. Maybe so they stuck to their style, almost to a fault, but that adds to the appeal, and it adds to the appeal of a player like Zico. So yeah, he's right up there for me.
You love a number 10.
There's a lot of them on this list, yeah.
yeah. And a lot of them are playing around the same sort of time that we've mentioned in the year. Sort of, as you said, 80s, mid-80s was a great time for the number 10. And yeah.
Yeah, there hasn't been as many in a similar time frame since. It was just a perfect time for that style of player. Because I guess as the pragmatism and the slightly more negative approach came in, so by 1990, you know, that World Cup then, the world had utterly changed in terms of how teams were set up, and you just didn't get as much of a sort of carefree abandon and the artistry of it, if you like, quite so much anymore.
Yeah. Talking of pragmatism, I've gone for an Italian at number four. he's already been mentioned, Paolo Maldini. So, yeah, as much as he's got a lot of unfortunate stuff in his international career, it's still a bit of a mental international career that most people would be proud of.
A
few records in there. He's got most minutes played at in World Cups. He was part of the defence that kept 5 consecutive clean sheets at a World Cup. And I don't know if this is a record, but he had 11 clean sheets at a World Cup. And I mean, a lot of people struggle to get 11 games at a World Cup.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you talked there of the 5 consecutive clean sheets. Obviously, that was Italia 90. And then they only let in 1 goal in a meaningful game anyway. I know England got another against in the third place playoff. But just that one goal, that one sort of flick from Caniggia's head, and suddenly all the confidence drained away. It was bizarre. But yeah, so it was a very strong defence that he was a part of in many an Italian side.
Yeah, I think Baresi was missing from a few of those games as well. So
certainly in 94, yeah. I mean, Baresi started the 94 World Cup and then went off for a knee operation and then came back in time for the final.
Yeah, and that game, that performance from Baresi in the final was ridiculous. There's a lot of viral clips of that.
Yeah.
That he sort of marked Mario and the like out of the game. But yeah, Maldini was a big part of that as well. And went through the ages from the 82 winning side to the 2006 winning side. But yeah, unfortunately wasn't part of either of those.
No, but a fabulously great player though. So yeah, we're in agreement on there. We just might have put different numbers on it.
Yeah. Number 3.
Okay, I have gone for, going further back in time, I've gone to the 50s, I've gone for Ferenc Puskas. And again, as you mentioned with the Dutch team of the 70s, there's several you could pick out from this team, I think, in terms of their impact. I think Coxis in particular was such a prolific scorer at that time that he's one that could easily have picked. But I think Puskas is the one who sort of transcends it all. He was obviously the star man, the galloping major, as he was called. Now, you're right in saying that he didn't play in all of the World Cup. He missed 2 games, the quarterfinal and the semi-final, because he'd got a hairline fracture of the ankle inflicted by a West German in the group game, which Hungary won 8-3. West Germany were a weakened side on that occasion, deliberately weakened,
I would point out. Fun and games.
It was, but bizarre format that time, though, because Hungary won the group. Now, it was a weird group stage because you only played 2 of the other 3 teams. So if you were seeded, you played the 2 non-seeds, but you didn't play the other seeded team. Now, bizarrely, Hungary was seeded, West Germany weren't. So they did have to play each other. But they didn't play 3 group games like you'd expect. But anyway, Hungary got through as group winners, oddly into a half of the draw with the other 3 group winners, whereas all 3 runners-up were on the other half of the draw. Now, that's just weird to me. I do not get that at all. You know, I've read all sorts about World Cup history, but that just makes no sense to me. This was the weirdest format. Now, how you can have the 4 group winners all against each other in the quarterfinals and subsequent semi-final, I do not know. But Hungary came through that without Puskas in a big battle, as it really was, against Brazil in the quarterfinal. And then a fabulous semi-final win over Uruguay. This was a Uruguay who'd never been beaten in a World Cup at this point. So this was World Cup holders as they were from 1950, but they'd only taken part in 1930 and 1950 and won them both. So this was their first ever World Cup defeat. This was World Cup holders against Olympic champions as Hungary were, which in those days, especially for a team from Eastern Europe, was pretty much as good a competition as the World Cup. In many ways, given the strong opposition they were up against, you know, this was professionalism in all but name. They were all employed by the army or other government ministries rather than as footballers, but essentially they were professional footballers. And Hungary won the 52 Olympics. They then obviously had a huge victory against England in 1953, which is England's great awakening. They beat them 6-3 at Wembley, and then a few months later in Budapest for a return game, they beat England 7-1 just a few weeks before the World Cup. So this was their peak, arguably. To then get to the World Cup final and lose to West Germany with Puskas back in the side. Now, he wasn't fully fit. Like I say, he'd had a fracture of the ankle a week or 10 days earlier. But he was fit enough to score in the final and to also score in inverted commas again. Yeah, in the last few minutes with a goal that was controversially ruled offside. He maintained to his dying day it should have been given. YouTube is slightly inconclusive, unfortunately. But from the angles you can see, it does look suspiciously onside. So I think the impact of him not being fully fit wasn't on his performance. I think he still performed to a level that was beyond what any replacement could have done, but it did cause a bit of an adjustment in the lineup. Had they just put him back in his position and left everything else the same, potentially it would have played out differently. Who knows? We'll never know, sadly. But this is one of those who, obviously with the theme of my book, it kind of speaks to that quite a lot. But this is one of the most painful losses, because they won every single game for 4 years prior to that World Cup final. Yeah. They then won every game for the next 2 years after it. They still lost one game in 6 years, and it was the World Cup final. I mean, that is just a sporting tragedy. For Puskás, he was their star guy in a team of stars. There were several. You know, you could talk of Hidiguchi in his role and what that brought, rather than sheer number of goals, because that was Cox's for the number of goals. But Hidiguchi, with that withdrawn position, dictated a lot of how the play went. There was Josip Bosic as well, Grosics in goal. There was lots of absolute star players of their time, but Puskás was above them all. And obviously he then went on, you know, when the revolution came in 1956, he was abroad with his club, Honved, at the time. Many of those players never returned to Hungary, at least not until many, many years later. And he obviously forced a career with Real Madrid, and what he went on to achieve there was quite incredible given his physical state at that time. He was getting on a bit, and he was a bit overweight and so on, but the talent was very much still there. But when it comes to this World Cup story, he was the symbol of the team, the symbol of that time, and it's a team that really, really should have won.
I find it hard to argue against Puskás because he's one of my favourite players of the past. But I didn't have him in mind because of the fact that he did miss an injury, but still he missed them two crucial games. So it is hard. It's hard to put him in there. But I would also struggle against it because it's empty. I do. Yeah, he is one of my all-time favourites.
Yeah.
And I just love the story, so...
I think it stands out for me because, obviously, for a nation like Hungary, their World Cup opportunities, it's not going to come again.
No.
That's just the brutal reality of it. No matter how strong a generation they get now, it's never going to be like that was. That's similar to Austria in the 30s, I guess, to some extent. They've got a past that they can never live up to, but Hungary take it another level beyond what Austria did. So it must be a shadow that's cast over every future Hungarian generation, that they can never, ever live up to this team and what they did achieve and what they almost achieved.
Yeah. And for me, I think they're better than 74 Netherlands. And
82%. Well, that's a whole other list.
Yeah, we've done it. I just obsessed with this lot as a kid. So, they're right up there. But, my number three, I know he's not on yours because you put him as an honourable mention, and that is Karl-Heinz Rummenigge. So, nine World Cup goals. I think that's only behind Miroslav Klose from a German perspective. Two-time runner-up, scored in one of the finals, a bit like Neskins there. And he was just in that wrong era of German football again. Like, if he had been born 10 years later, then he would have definitely had a World Cup and a couple of Euros or something like that. We had on Ralf Honigstein recently, and he he was talking about like the best Bundesliga 11 of his lifetime, and he said that Rummenigge was the best player in that side, the best player that he'd seen in the Bundesliga in the last 40 years, and his favourite player. And yeah, he really does just fall into the wrong timing,
yeah.
Really.
But yeah,
he
he's a fine
really
player.
Do much more for himself, like to win a World Cup. Those sort of numbers, still turning up in the big games as well. And I think he's probably a little bit forgotten about. I think him and Kevin Keegan are two around that sort of time that, because they both were sort of preceded by, you know, a lot of players that won the World Cup, they don't get talked about at the same sort of level, but they probably were a similar level to.
Oh, undoubtedly. Yeah, undoubtedly. It's just the misfortune of timing, as you say. He had the good fortune to come from a country that would challenge for these things, and to have the skills he had. But yeah, the misfortune to just missed out on either side. 74 and 1990, if only he could have expanded his career out one way or the other.
Yeah, it's just a bit like Maldini, that one. Just horrible timing.
Yeah.
I think we've got the same top two, but
well,
I'd be interested to see if you've got number two.
Yes. Well, I've got Roberto Baggio as number two. So whether that's the same as you or not, I'm not sure. But
it is not. No.
It is not. Okay. Well, Roberto Baggio, I mean, yes, another number 10, another fabulously gifted, wonderful player. The goal he scored against Czechoslovakia in 1990 is imprinted in my mind from the time. It was magnificent. And this was coming off the back of just prior to the World Cup, having made a move from Fiorentina to Juventus, hugely controversially, against his will as well. But, you know, it caused quite the stir in Italy. And this was his sudden emergence onto the international scene. That was their third group game when he really sort of got the bit between his teeth. He wasn't in the starting lineup for the beginning of the World Cup, but he sort of fought his way in the same way that Scilacci did as well. But, you know, he was an infinitely more gifted player than Scilacci, and obviously his impact would go on far beyond Scilacci's in terms of Italian football. But this was such a huge breakthrough on the international and the World Cup scene. I remember the commentary distinctly as well of that's the goal all of Italy's been waiting for. And it was, because it, again, I talked about how this was supposed to be their tournament. They believed it. And this, just when the doubts had crept in from tough couple of games to begin with in terms of how they'd performed, suddenly the belief, he made the whole country believe again. I don't just believe in the possible, believe in the certainty, as they saw it, that it was going to play out the way their destiny seemed. And he, alongside Giannini in that midfield in 1990, with a sort of creative sparks, they saw their way through to the semi-final, as we know, but he was then dropped for the semi-final. Now, there was the return of Viali, which caused a little change in the lineup, but had the coach stuck to the winning formula that he'd lucked his way into to some extent. You know, Scilacci wasn't meant to be the main starting striker. He hadn't come from quite nowhere, as the fable may go, because he was a Juventus player and one of the top scorers in the Italian league that year. So it's not as though he wasn't meant to be in the squad. He certainly deserved his place, but he wasn't going to be a starter. But he fought his way in. And him and Baggio had become the sort of symbols. They were the ones who were pushing Italy through to victory. But then he changed this for the semi-final. He dropped Baggio. And when he ultimately brought Baggio on, it was to replace Giannini, so the other creative force. So that blunted what had been performing so well for Italy, and it changed how they played, and they lost confidence, as we say, when Caniggia scored, and it all went wrong. Baggio scored his penalty in the 1990 shootout, but ultimately to no avail. Obviously, 1994... in a personal perspective for him, was even more remarkable. He dragged Italy to that World Cup final almost single-handedly. This is a side who were not as good, to my mind, as the 1990 team across the board. They, on so many occasions, probably should have been booted out of the tournament. You know, they began with a loss to Ireland. They then scraped a win against Norway with only 10 men, having had the goalie sent off. In the first half, this was, and to bring on a substitute goalie, Arrigo Sacchi substituted off Roberto Baggio, his best player by far. But he wasn't fully fit, Roberto Baggio. He was wearing thigh strapping or hamstring strapping throughout the World Cup. He wasn't at his full powers, and yet the impact he still had was incredible. They then obviously scraped through their group in third place as well, so they would not have got through in a 32 team format. It was only because it was a 24 team tournament at the time, and as we know from recent Euros, that third place teams go through. Some of them. That's how they scraped through. They should have, could have easily lost to Nigeria in the next round. But he was the instigator of the fight back there. Last minute equaliser when they were about to be beaten. They were already down to 10 men. They should have had Maldini sent off in that game to come back to somebody else we mentioned. He was fortunate not to get a red. Baggio saved it and then scored a penalty to win it in extra time. He was then the hero against Spain in the quarterfinal as well with another majestic goal. The instant control on the outside of his foot as he nudged the ball past the Spanish goal. He was absolutely magnificent. And the way he fired in the shot just ahead of the backtracking Spanish defender was superb. He then took Bulgaria apart in the semi-final. And come the final, it was a game too far for a lot of people, that final. It was a poor showing in the end, unfortunately. The two biggest stars of the tournament, Baggio and Romario, didn't quite flourish in the way that many hoped they would. It wasn't quite the echoes of the 1970 final that many thought it could have been. He was unfit, he was struggling, and he was not quite at his peak, unfortunately. And yet, Italy would never even got close to that final without him, and he was still their best option in the final itself. When it came to it, obviously, we all know he missed the last spot kick. That had it gone in, Brazil would have still had the next kick to win it, so it's not quite maybe as definitive had he scored as it appears when he skied it over. But that it was a terrible, terrible end for someone who Italy would never have got close to the final without. You know, he was the driving force behind everything. Arrigo Sacchi was deeply, deeply unpopular in Italy at this time. Some Italians were actively rooting against Italy in the final because they couldn't bear the thought of Sacchi winning the World Cup and coming back to Italy with a trophy. But Baggio coming back with a trophy, that was another matter. And that would have been on a par with Maradona in 86, I would say, in terms of a personal achievement, to take a team that wasn't that great, to take them all the way to victory. If he'd been able to do that, that would have been on that level, I would argue. Such a shame for somebody who'd had that impact on the tournament to end the tournament in that way. He then obviously played in 1998. By this point, his career had a few peaks and troughs. He'd struggled to get over, obviously, as you would naturally. Missing a crucial penalty in a World Cup final takes a bit of getting over. And his career had taken a few other paths by the time of the 98 tournament, but he was back. And then I do vividly recall their first game against Chile. They got a penalty and there he is stepping up to take it. Oh my God, here we go. Please don't miss. Please don't miss. And he put it in. But the fact that he scored a penalty in 1990 and he scored a penalty in 98, but missed the one in 94. Heartbreaking for what a great player. One of the greats. Another 10 of that time, or slightly later than the 80s, I guess. Number 10 of the 90s in many ways. Incredible, incredible player. But yes, I stand by it. If he'd led Italy to victory in 94, that would have been an achievement to rank alongside Maradona in 86.
Yeah, so I've got him number one. And the reason he's number one for me over someone that you are going to mention is because I think they probably had a very similar level of impact. Maybe your number one had a higher impact in a single tournament, but he really was the star man on his team for two tournaments, and he just gave them hope. And Italy are known for their defence and stuff, but he was that creative spark and just really the kind of outstanding player in that side, possibly even more so than, I'm going to say his name, Johan Cruyff. So, I just think it's a numbers game of two great tournaments versus one. But Cruyff is very much a top shout for the number one spot as well. And to be honest, he's the first person that came to my head when I thought about this topic. I think he's probably the most iconic one of all the players that haven't won it.
Yeah. Yeah, so yes, I will confirm that's number one. I did put Johan Cruyff. but you're right, he is the character, the image is of him is what comes to mind when you think of not winning a World Cup. I think he's become so synonymous with that. I get everything you're saying there about Baggio and it makes a lot of sense. But it is just that sort of iconography of it that brings Cruyff in, and it's the deeper influence he's had of not just over that 74 Dutch team, which was obviously the influence he had on that was massive. He was effectively the coach on the field. He was the definition of total football. You know, he was the one who taught that as much as Nichols did, as much as others through the Ajax school of total football. It was only because of Cruyff that it could really flourish and happen to that extent anyway. And I think to then have the impact he had on that tournament in terms of the performances, the goals, the way that he then channeled the team's performance into pushing it all the way towards the final, even the moments that didn't come in victory. So the famous Cruyff turn came in a goalless draw with Sweden in a group game. Now, we tend not to see what happened before or after the Cruyff turn, but it's kind of significant as well because the move that led to it came from a couple of players out of position. You know, there was a defender up on the right wing playing it across to a midfielder who was playing in defence to Cruyff, who was playing on the left, which would more naturally have been the realm of Rensenbrink on other occasions or on this particular day, Pete Kaiser. But Cruyff was there. He then did his wonderful Cruyff turn, crossed the ball in, and it led to absolutely nothing. We don't see that. It was like a moment of beauty, a moment of fabulous genius brought about through total football, but led to no tangible reward. And that's a kind of metaphor for the whole thing in my mind of, you know, the greatness it could produce, but sadly no tangible reward. In the final, obviously, he was the instigator of this goal that happened without Germany touching the ball. He dropped as deep as all the defenders to pick up the ball, slow paced passing it around. That was all that was happening. And then suddenly he burst forward, stormed through, panicked, got past a panicking Bertie Vogt, who was his man marker. And then he was brought down by Holtzenbein, I think, in the box. It was the only way of stopping him as he charged through and Naiskin scored the penalty. There's so many theories as to what happened next, of why they didn't go on and win it as they could and should have done. They toyed with the Germans. It was kind of some of the sort of stories about it talk about trying to mock the Germans and basically humiliate them. It was kind of, it wasn't done in a goading way. It was done at sort of keeping them at arm's length, trying to just keep possession, try just effectively to win the World Cup without letting West Germany play at all, rather than going for the jugular and really pushing on. Sadly for them, by half time, West Germany had not only got themselves back in with a highly dubious penalty of their own, but they'd gone ahead thanks to Gerd Müller turning on a sixpence and scoring. And the second half, though, was, again, it was all the Dutch. It was so much attacking play from them. The fact that they didn't score was testament as much to German defence and Sepp Maier as it was to any profligacy or misfortune. Again, it's just a painful one, like you talk about the Hungary of 54. It's another painful one where, to everyone's mind, or many people's mind rather than everyone,
German minds probably don't care either of those finals, the ones who benefited on both occasions. But to many minds, it's obviously the wrong result is what happened. He didn't go to 78, as you say. Theories abounded about whether this was to do with a protest about the Argentinian regime, but it was much more simplistic in that he, not long beforehand, had been armed intruders in his home in Barcelona and had tied up his wife and so on, and there was various trauma coming from that, and this was the reason he didn't want to leave his family for a couple of months to go to a World Cup. So that only came out closer to his death, I think. That's the truth of it, which is understandable. You know, he was someone who had a fair bit of perspective on it all in terms of victory and loss. He saw the 74 defeat as a moral victory in many ways, because they were remembered far more than the victors. A central theme to the book I wrote, obviously a bit of an inspiration for the theme there. But it's very true when it comes to that Dutch team of 74. They are remembered more than the victors, even though that West German team had elements of the total football style themselves. They're just not quite to the same extent. Bayern Munich at that time had just taken over from Ajax as the foremost team in Europe. So, you know, this wasn't a shock result by any means.
They'd won Euros, hadn't they? 2 years.
Oh, yeah. And that was probably their actual peak. It was 72, I would suggest. And 74 was just past it, whereas that was the Dutch peak. So the results should have really gone the other way. But there's the Germans for you, always just winning even when you don't think they should. But yeah, I think the sort of lasting impact that team has had, and with him being a central character to it, in fact, the cause of much of what they were able to do to achieve, that's why I've put him as number one.
Yeah, as I say, he was definitely the first one that came to mind, and he does have a big shout of being that for sure. What I might do on this, might put a poll out actually to say who. out of the two, Fazio and Cruyff, and we'll see what the crowd decide on that. But
yes,
yeah, that was definitely one of the most difficult lists that I've done. But yeah, cheers, Aidan, for coming on. And before we let you go, if you want to say a little bit about your book.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. It's been brilliant fun, as I said at the start, a tricky homework assignment. It was really hard. Really hard to do, so hopefully we've between us managed to justify many of the decisions and sway each other a little bit on some of them. My book, thanks for that, is called The Nearly Men, The Eternal Allure of the Greatest Teams That Failed to Win the World Cup. So many of the people that are featured in this discussion feature in that book as well. So yes, that is available from all the usual places. And equally, I'm on Twitter as well, at @Yad_Williams or at Nearly Men Cup, which is the one that goes with the book. So any sort of chat about this topic or the book, I'd be more than happy to engage with anybody on that.
Nice one. Yeah, I think this topic really just spoke to you, I think. giving you right back before. So.
But I think it's one, as we talk about with many of these players, I think it's one that appeals to a lot of people because there's that what if about it, or there's some sliding doors moment. There's the sort of pain that we see the correct, what we see is the correct outcome not happening. And that's frustrating as a football fan, but everyone experiences this, whether it's with your club, whether it's with some other team you follow, or whether it's at a World Cup. You know, we've all experienced injustices the way we see it. Other people see it, each of those differently. So that's why it's something people will never fully agree on. And probably people will disagree with some of those I talk about in my book and have other ideas, but that's as you would expect. And that's why it's such a good topic to discuss.
Yeah. There's a lot of different names that can be bandied about, a lot more than some of the other ones we've done, but yeah, I think this has definitely been one of the most interesting to come up with, and yeah, definitely one of the most difficult as well. But yeah, thanks again, Aidan, and remember to keep it.